It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a proposal in the Wisconsin Assembly would lower the age for concealed carry of firearms from 21 to 18. We'll talk to the sponsor of the bill and then to a gun policy expert on regulations for younger gun owners. First, the State Department of Health Services says about 59% of Wisconsinites have gotten fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But the pace of vaccinations has slowed down a lot over the last few months. With cases surging again in the state and hospitals short-staffed, public health officials are continuing to make the case for getting vaccinated. A recent effort by Marshfield Clinic Health System in central and northern Wisconsin is showing some signs of success. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked to loved ones in your own life about getting vaccinated? Have you noticed a message or a strategy that's persuasive? If you are a healthcare worker, what kind of conversations do you have with the patients you work with? Do you see high or low vaccination rates in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Miranda Egebrecht is Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care with Marshfield Clinic Health System. Miranda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
What made Marshfield Clinic want to take on this effort of trying to reach out to people who hadn't gotten vaccinated or at least not yet?
Yeah, well, first, we learned very early in the pandemic that individuals really want information. They want to know what's going on. They want accurate data so that they can make informed decisions. And so we wanted to be part of that conversation. We know historically that people value their opinions, thoughts, and background that healthcare providers can give. And so that was really one of our motivating factors of us reaching out to our patients and communities to be able to provide that accurate information so, again, they can make the best informed decision for them.
You serve a lot of rural communities, and just looking at county maps of Wisconsin, rural counties, many of them anyway, have lower vaccination rates. Was that a particular focus of your outreach effort?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, when we look at the state data, we know that there's still work to be done in terms of vaccination. But in particular, our service area for Marshfield Clinic Health System does include a few counties with some of the lowest rates in the state. And so we, again, wanted to be that resource to provide that information and education where we're needed to answer questions or concerns that folks had so that we can really improve the health of communities. The more people we can get vaccinated, the better protected the communities are.
So can you talk about specifically what kind of outreach you did to your Marshfield Clinic patients?
Yeah, so with our campaign, we had a couple different arms. So first, we knew, again, that we needed to be mindful of how we delivered messages. So in particular, making sure that we had media materials that were available in English, Hmong, and Spanish, and a variety of media materials. So billboards, social media, streaming services. So that, again, the more that was out there, hopefully the more individuals could receive that information. And again, in the language that they prefer. We also did an email campaign. So again, as a way for our own patients, we could really directly communicate with them and share those resources, share the recommendations from our healthcare providers directly, and then again, provide any further resources to them so that they could continue to explore and have those trusted resources available at their fingertips.
We're talking about COVID-19 vaccination outreach. Miranda Egebrecht is with us from Marshfield Clinic Health System, Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care there, looking at efforts to talk to people who aren't vaccinated, answer their questions, get them information. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi. I think we're past information, the information stage. There's been information going on 2 years almost now that we've had vaccinations and information. And information isn't the problem or lack of information. It's the fact that people don't believe the information. This has turned into a political football. You have one political party that is disparaging vaccinations and efforts for people to wear masks. You have news channels and these right-wing channels like Fox News that is disparaging vaccinations. It's become such a political football. It's like it's past conversation. It's ingrained right now. You're not going to change people's thinking because all the information you give them, they're not going to believe it anyways. It's fake news.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Miranda, I wanted to ask you about the results of reaching out to people in the conversations you've had. Mike might be right about some people, but it sounds like in some cases, people did decide to get vaccinated.
Yeah, certainly when we talk about vaccine readiness, we see the continuum, right? We see people who have made up their minds on both ends of the spectrum, but certainly there are a lot of people who still really want that one-on-one conversation so that they can really dig into some of the questions that they may have. And that's where I feel, you know, our providers are ready. They're willing to have that conversation, really ready to understand and see, you know, where people are coming from and understand what they may be thinking and help to provide information that would be valuable for them. Within some of our outreach campaigns, within 2021, we were able to provide over 175,000 COVID vaccines, again, among many of our vulnerable populations. And again, we were able to open those doors up and have many conversations in our office setting and in our communities about, you know, those specific questions, specific concerns that individuals have, so that again they can see the big scope and make those decisions for themselves.
What were some of the most common questions or concerns that people had that were addressed in this email campaign, or maybe in one-on-one conversations with a healthcare provider?
Yeah, so, you know, again, we see a variety of questions. Some of them are specific to where people may be at in their life. So women who are in childbearing years may have different questions or concerns compared to older male counterparts, or parents now of younger children may have more specific concerns. So, you know, a lot of questions around the safety of the vaccines, how we were able to have a vaccine so quickly, the long-term side effects. Those were a lot of those repeat questions or concerns that we had that we were able to, again, have some conversations with, put together some information, some handouts, put together PSAs, and then again, point others to CDC, to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and other reliable resources.
How much of a concern has access been? I know at various stages, that's been one reason that people have cited for not getting vaccinations. They know the vaccines are out there, but it might involve taking time off work that they don't have, or getting transportation or childcare, or, you know, the list goes on and on. How big a part of the story is that?
Sure. Very early on, you're right. We did see that was a challenge for many. We needed to work with the supply that we had. We needed to work with other community vaccinators to make sure that we could see the scope and what was accessible. Now it's more easily accessible. We have a greater supply. We have that on hand. We have some easy access in terms of online self-scheduling that's available to patients. We have some walk-in clinics available to individuals. We try and make sure that we have hours available outside of those regular business hours. So again, when you talk about work or school and the ability to get there at a time that works well, we do have that variety. So hopefully that access has improved for others, and we continue to listen. So, you know, what is it that individuals need in terms of that access, making it readily available at existing appointments, for example, or being somewhere else that's more maybe available and open in the community.
We've heard concerns in Wisconsin and elsewhere during this Omicron surge that healthcare providers, hospitals in particular, again, getting overwhelmed with an increase in COVID-19 cases. What kind of things are you hearing around Marshfield Clinic providers?
Yeah, absolutely. So like everybody else, we've been in this now for almost 2 years. And so we're tired. We're all ready to be out of the pandemic. But we continue to work hard to be mindful of what we need in terms of providing care when individuals need that hospitalization. We're trying to be mindful of what can we do to prevent that hospitalization from happening. We're working hard to make sure, again, that we continue to stress the importance of masking, of vaccination. We're working hard to make sure that we're providing the testing resource that's available for individuals individual so that they can, again, make decisions sooner. So every step along the way, when we talk about prevention all the way up into the needs that individuals may have in terms of hospitalization, we're working around the clock, making sure that we're doing everything that we can. But certainly we know that this has been very stressful. And this surge is, you know, again, another surge in this 2-year-long stretch. And so we're asking individuals to continue to do your part, continue to mask. If you haven't been vaccinated, get the vaccine, get the booster if you're able to. We're in this together, but we need to continue to take some steps moving forward.
Miranda, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Miranda Egebrecht. She's Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care with Marshfield Clinic Health System. She was with us today to talk about Marshfield Clinic's email campaign and conversation campaign with patients that it says drove about 100,000 vaccinations. Up next, we'll continue the conversation. A journalist joins us who spent time talking to Americans who are vaccine hesitant and those who opposed the vaccine. She'll tell us more about the wide range of attitudes and beliefs. It's not necessarily all or nothing for a lot of people. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you on the fence with getting the COVID-19 at some point? What pushed you one way or another? Or has that not happened yet? Do you have conversations with people in your life about whether or not they should get vaccinated? What sort of concerns do you hear from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about Americans who are unvaccinated against the virus that causes COVID-19, what's leading to hesitancy for some people. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic, your experiences, maybe what kind of decision-making process you might have gone through before getting vaccinated, or if you're having conversations with others, if you work in healthcare, maybe conversations with your patients. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Julie Bosman joins us now. She's the Chicago Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She's profiled a number of unvaccinated Americans last summer in a piece titled, "Who Are the Unvaccinated in America? There's No One Answer." Julie, welcome back to Wisconsin and to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What led you and your colleagues to try to take a closer look on the reasons people gave for holding off on getting vaccines?
Well, I think that the stories that we've written about unvaccinated Americans have come from trying to answer a really simple question: who are the unvaccinated? What are their reasons? You know, what are they thinking? What are their motivations? And one thing that I have discovered over and over again when writing these articles is just that there are really complicated reasons for why people have chosen not to be vaccinated. And this is not one big monolithic group. This is not necessarily a group of people who are, you know, anti-vaxxers in the way that they've been portrayed in some corners of the media. Some people just have really complicated personal reasons for not getting vaccinated. And a lot of people in this big group of Americans is still kind of willing to be persuaded under the right circumstances.
That's what really struck me reading your piece. I think it's sometimes easy in the media or watching or listening to the media to say there's two groups. You know, one group enthusiastically got the vaccines as soon as they were eligible. Another is dug in and will never, ever, ever do it. There's a lot of middle ground there.
Absolutely. I mean, I found this in my own life that, you know, the cousins, friends, people who are not vaccinated, you know, they have reasons that, you know, sometimes they even have trouble articulating, or they have emotional reasons. They may have heard of a friend who had a bad reaction to a vaccine, and that was enough to scare them away. So there's a lot of power in the personal anecdote. And I think that examples like that just show how tough it is to understand, you know, who this group of people is and how to persuade them. If you're a public health official, you're trying to convince people to get vaccinated so that the pandemic can finally, you know, start to wane at last. And I think that's what has made this such a big challenge for public health officials.
You started to touch on this. Can you share a couple more of the personal stories that you and your colleagues heard from people as to why they weren't against vaccination, but weren't ready to get it quite yet at the point you talked to them?
Sure. I mean, some people just, you know, they worried about the time span. They said, look, these vaccines were produced really quickly. I'm just going to wait and see. So there were plenty of people in that wait and see group. Now, of course, we are a year into vaccine availability in the United States. So I think the wait and see group is probably diminishing at this point. You know, some people just said, you know, I stood outside of a vaccine clinic in Chicago one day last summer and just talked to everybody who was going in. And I talked to one man who was in his 70s and just said, look, I was a little worried. I feel like I'm really healthy. I don't think I need this, but I wanted to visit a friend who is a lot older than me and she's in fragile health. So I didn't think it would be responsible to do that if I was unvaccinated. So here I am. So sometimes it just comes down to a really specific set of circumstances. There are a lot of people who said that they were doing it because they were getting ready to go to school in the fall, or their college required it, or their, you know, work required it, their employer required it. So a lot of people have been swayed by mandates as they've come and gone.
Talking to Julie Bosman from the New York Times, Chicago bureau chief there, talking about unvaccinated Americans, vaccine hesitancy when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccinations. And it's not all or nothing. It's not yes or no. There's a lot of maybe out there. You could join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Jeff is with us in Wausau. Jeff, hi.
Hi, Rob. Just glad to say that I've got the vaccine. I believe in modern science. I believe in good old-fashioned journalism, and I believe in both of you. Thanks for inviting us all along on this information journey. I'm wondering if anybody speculated on the numbers. If nobody took another booster, if nobody took another vaccine, what's the absolute worst-case scenario for fatalities and long-term illness? Thank you for taking my question.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Julie, I'm not sure if that's the sort of numbers you have researched or reported on yourself, but it seems like the data from hospitals is showing pretty clearly the more people who get vaccinated, the fewer people end up with serious problems in the hospital.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think I have the precise numbers on that, but I can say that one number that really hasn't budged very much in the last few months is the percentage of Americans who are fully vaccinated, and that's still around 63%. Now that includes children who are younger than 5 who are not eligible yet for the vaccine. But in terms of hospitalization, severe illness, death, I've talked to many emergency room doctors, many physicians, nurses who have said when they look at their hospitals right now, when they look at their ICUs, when they see who's in the COVID units, it is the majority of those patients are unvaccinated, and the patients who are vaccinated are generally not boosted. So it's a pretty consistent finding across a lot of hospitals in the United States that if you are boosted, you are almost certainly not going to end up severely ill or dying from this infection, which is the point of vaccination. You know, we've certainly found out that the Omicron variant is spreading among fully vaccinated and boosted people, but most of those people are not getting severely ill. So that's the goal of the vaccines.
And the New York Times has done polling on why hesitant people don't want to get vaccinated. I know you've been following the issue since that initial report that you did that we talked about earlier. Have things changed when it comes to why people aren't getting vaccinated, or have the people who are on the fence maybe by now made up their mind one way or the other?
Well, one thing that has shifted things slightly is the Omicron variant, that about half of vaccinated adults who are not boosted say that the Omicron variant makes them more likely to get that booster. it hasn't changed many minds among unvaccinated adults. The latest numbers that I saw from a health organization is that among unvaccinated adults, only about 12% of them said that they were more likely to get the COVID vaccine because of the Omicron variant. So there's certainly a lot of people who are really dug in at this point and are not willing to change their minds.
Let's round one more caller. Christopher is with us in Elkhorn. Christopher, hi.
Hello. I was just calling to state some, you know, what I've observed about, you know, most people in my personal life about why they choose not to get the vaccine, and usually always revolves around, you know, not trusting what, you know, the media says, or not understanding, you know, the specifics about like mRNA, or, you know, just generally not understanding the science behind it. And I was curious if, you know, either of you are aware of any plans or programs that are being talked about with, you know, trying to, you know, help with educating the general community about, you know, helping to make the right choice.
Christopher, thanks for that call. Julie, just before we talked to you, we heard from Marshfield Clinic here in Madison, who's trying to do just that, using the contacts between doctors and their patients. Do we see that happening elsewhere? Do we know if that is a more successful approach with the public that in some cases might not trust any big scale institution?
Yeah, I mean, I think that raises such a good point. Like, who are the trusted figures? You know, who it's, we've certainly seen in the last 2 years that local public health directors, state public health directors have been harassed by some people. They've been accused of lying, of spreading mistruths, when really these are people who are just trying to, you know, give information to the public. They're trying to communicate what the CDC is saying. One thing that I've heard just in my reporting is that people are much more likely to listen to their own doctor or their own nurse if they have a relationship with, you know, a physician or a trusted healthcare worker. Then they're much more likely to listen to that person. But there are so many people in this country who do not have a primary care doctor, who don't have someone who they can go to regularly. So that's something that, you know, is something that happened before the pandemic, that people just don't have a relationship with a doctor. That's becoming a really acute problem now that we're in a pandemic.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julie Bosman, Chicago Bureau Chief for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her profile last summer of unvaccinated Americans. Earlier, we talked to Miranda Egebrecht of Marshfield Clinic about an email campaign they say helped drive 100,000 vaccinations. Coming up, we talk with the sponsor of a proposal that would lower the minimum age for concealed carry in Wisconsin from 21 to 18. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, companies are investing millions and millions of dollars on the world of virtual reality. We'll learn more about what's known as the metaverse and why it's getting so much hype lately. Now, a proposal in Wisconsin's State Assembly would lower the age required to apply for a concealed carry permit from 21 to 18. 18 to 20-year-olds are allowed to purchase firearms, but they're not allowed to purchase from licensed dealers. Instead, must buy from private sellers. We're talking now about concealed carry and gun rights and regulations for 18 to 20-year-olds here in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of concealed carry generally? Do you think that the age should go from 21 down to 18 to apply for concealed carry permits? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers, representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He's sponsoring this assembly bill that would lower the minimum age to apply for a concealed carry permit. Representative Sortwell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us why you want to lower the age here for concealed carry from 21 to 18?
Sure. You know, the issue is pretty basic, and I know, you know, you kind of kicked it off with this idea of this thing about gun rights and everything, but actually, I would actually say that it goes beyond gun rights. And it goes to the basic premise of equality under the law. And really, it's not really so much about the Second Amendment as it is about the 14th Amendment, which is that anybody who is an adult should be treated equally under the law. You know, if we have somebody who's 18, 19, or 20 years old, they have the same rights as somebody who's 22, 23, 24, 25, or 99 years old. And so that's what really this is about, is it's saying we can't kind of artificially pick an age and deny somebody an inherent right, the inherent right to defend yourself, simply because they're not 21 years old yet. If they are an adult, they have those inherent rights, and it is our duty under the Constitution to respect everybody's rights.
We do have some cases, some products, alcohol and tobacco, notably, where we do divide different kinds of adults, 18 to 20, 21 and up. I think you just hinted at this being a constitutional right. How would you distinguish, say, firearms from alcohol and tobacco?
Sure. Well, you know, we can have that discussion. And to be honest, I really am somebody who does support kind of one age of majority, that, you know, at that age, you know, we should treat you as an adult. And I think we should do that. If we want to choose 21, well, we can choose 21. But even on that, despite that distinction where I think the state should go and simply say, this is when you're an adult and you can vote and you can make contracts and you can drink and everything else. Even beyond that, though, I'm not aware of any provision in the Constitution, state or federally, that lists, you know, the inherent right to drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. But it does specifically say in the Constitution of the state that you have, that adults have a right to possess firearms for self-defense, for hunting, and for any other legal purpose. And then we have the Second Amendment of the federal Constitution that lists those rights. And so, you know, that's how this is different, is that we acknowledge this as an inherent right. And if it's an inherent right, it must be equal to all of our adult citizens.
As some critics of the idea to lower the law have pointed toward this sort of weird bit of federal law when it comes to the purchase of firearms by 18 to 20-year-olds. As I understand it, 18 to 20-year-olds can't buy them from licensed dealers and go through background checks. They can buy them privately. They're just worried, I think, about the more difficult to track and difficult to background check zone that would put these 18 to 20-year-olds in. Do you have thoughts on that concern?
Well, first of all, I would note that a circuit court this past summer actually noted that that's probably unconstitutional law right now anyways, to prohibit 18, 19, and 20-year-olds from purchasing handguns, once again, on kind of an arbitrary fashion. There's really no good reason why they should be denied those rights. And so that we'll see if that continues forward. That may end up being thrown out in our federal Supreme Court, say that you need to treat everybody equally before the law as it relates to that right as well. But even beyond that, even under current law, yes, it is true that somebody cannot purchase a firearm from a licensed dealer. They can either get it from a parent. They can get it, as you mentioned, from private party selling. But that's the point, isn't it? Is that's already legal under the law. They can already possess it in that way. What we are saying is, well, if you can already possess it, shouldn't we be able to simply follow the process that's in place right now for you to go to the state and go through the process and say, look, I've got training on how to use this firearm? I mean, do we feel safer right now with the idea that you can go out and buy it with, and we have no idea that you got it, rather than, hey, you know, Bill or Johnny or Sally decided to go out and get this permit, and now we know that you've got this permit and went through the training, so you actually know how to use them.
And as we wrap up, Representative Sortwell, what do you think about the prospects for passing this and the timeline?
I think it's going to pass in the Assembly tomorrow. Right. It's on the calendar for tomorrow, and I would be surprised if we don't move it through the full legislature. I think a lot of people understand that we need to treat everybody equally before the law.
Representative Sortwell, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He talked to us about a bill he's sponsoring that would lower the minimum age to obtain a concealed carry permit from 21 to 18. You can join in with your thoughts on that idea at 800-642-1234. Now we're going to look at how this fits into concealed carry laws around the country and regulations for younger gun owners. Robert Spitzer is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York at Cortland, author of over a dozen books, including 5 on gun policy. The most recent is The Politics of Gun Control. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So Wisconsin, we allow concealed carry 21 and up. This law would change it to 18 to 20. How does that fit in with concealed carry laws around the country?
Well, it is part of a broader movement that we've seen in recent years to loosen concealed carry laws and to make it easier for people to get guns and to carry, for civilians to carry them about with them. The thing is, people think of that as a return to our past, but it's actually the opposite of our past. From the late 1600s to the start of the 20th century, every state in the country except three restricted or completely barred civilian gun carrying. It's only been in the last few decades, beginning in the 1980s, where we've seen a new movement to make it easier for civilians to carry guns around with them. And there are perfectly good, not only, there's a legal constitutional question, but there's also a public policy question. And I think the idea of reducing the age from 21 to 18 raises a number of troubling problems, both with respect to public policy, and I don't think it imposes an undue constitutional burden to keep the age at 21.
What problems do you see it raising?
Well, most immediately, you're talking about making handguns accessible to the ages 18 to 20, and we know that late teenagers, in that age period are part of the cohort of people more likely to commit crimes. Most crimes are committed by young adults. In addition, we know that teenagers are still developing. They tend to be more impulsive, more subject to mood swings, that they tend to lack judgment and experience. They're subject to depression, anger. And we know that when handguns become more accessible, that is to say, when people turn 21, gun suicides increase. And it does matter what you use if you're contemplating suicide. And a gun is the most lethal method of suicide available. So it poses a risk in terms of suicide and also in terms of acting out behavior that we have seen repeatedly in the news.
As you heard from Representative Sortwell there, though, if we're making laws regarding things that are in the Constitution related to constitutional rights, shouldn't we treat all people we agree who are adults equally?
Well, the question begins with what do you mean by an adult? And as you pointed out in the discussion, age of adulthood, depending on the activity involved, can range in the modern era from 18 to 21. But that question aside, we know that the Second Amendment does not bar gun regulation. Restricting guns from young people goes back decades and, in fact, nearly 200 years in our own past. And the government in general has wide latitude to regulate firearms. That also is part of the little-known story of our gun past. And as a matter of public policy, the government is well within its rights to say that for a responsibility as significant as gun ownership, we believe that we should set the bar a little higher rather than a little lower. There's nothing magical about 18 versus 21. It depends on the activity. And given the history of gun regulations in all of these areas, the government, it seems to me, is well within its rights to impose regulations. And I would just add that the Fourth Circuit federal court decision that struck down gun regulations, handgun restrictions to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds was a decision that was then reversed a couple of months later. So the current law is not in the Fourth Circuit, sustains the 21-year-old age limit.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Lac des Flambeaux. Tom, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Tom?
I'm wondering, I'm all for the concealed carry to go down to 18, but like the purchasing of firearms, they should be able to purchase them at 18 as well.
Tom, thanks for the call. And that is kind of a weird wrinkle in federal law that we mentioned earlier, Bob, that and correct me if I'm wrong, 18 to 20-year-olds can't buy from a federal licensed dealer who does background checks. They could buy from any other private gun seller. Can you talk about that, a bit of weirdness?
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the federal regulation occurs via the restrictions and the regulations that pertain to a federally licensed firearms dealer, an FFL. But in most states, you can purchase guns privately from a private person who, you know, wants to sell some guns or sells some guns on the side and who is not a licensed dealer and therefore doesn't fall under the federal rubric. It does seem a bit odd. And I think it's simply a limitation in terms of how that law is written. But it's true that if you're 18, 19, 20, and it's legal for you to get a handgun, yes, you could buy it from a private dealer.
Tom, thanks for calling on from Lac de Flambeau. Bob Spitzer is with us, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland, talking to us about concealed carry policies, and especially those for gun owners between 18 and 20. A proposed Wisconsin law would lower the minimum age for concealed carry from 21 to 18. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see that change made? Do you have questions about how this works, what precedents there are around the country? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with political scientist Bob Spitzer about laws on gun ownership and concealed carry under age 21. That is the current minimum age for concealed carry in Wisconsin. A proposal in the state legislature, we talked to one of the sponsors earlier, would lower that to 18. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that or your questions, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Blake is with us in Madison. Blake, hi.
Hi. So I'm a person of color for Madison. I'm a concealed carry holder. I'm all for the expansion of rights for permissible gun owners, 18, 19, and 20. I think this is just an evolution of Wisconsin politics. We saw the unbanning of automatic knives, which was originally in place to go after Hispanic and Black youths when switchblades were popular. I think this is just an evolution of that, where we're allowing permissible gun owners to practice their rights at 18, 19, and 20. These people can already vote. They can already own handguns and firearms. I don't see any reason we should bar them from a constitutional right. Thank you.
Blake, thanks for the call. Bob, what do you think?
Well, interesting point. He mentioned in passing knives. I'm assuming he's referring to what sometimes people call switchblades.
Right.
And I've spent a lot of time looking at old gun laws. And one of the things you find is that when gun carrying was restricted, and again, this goes back over 200 years in America, so were certain specific name types of knives. Knives that had long, thin blades or concealed blades that were used in interpersonal fighting. So the regulation of knives, in certain types of knives, is actually as old as the regulation of concealed carry. Again, back to the 1800s and 1700s.
Blake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thanks, Rob. I'd like to talk about the first half of the Second Amendment, basically militia types being regulated by the president, as it's stated. These people who aligned themselves or affiliated themselves with militias back in January 6th, shouldn't we have these people's names?
Jim, I don't want to go necessarily to January 6th here, Bob, but the idea he's mentioning the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment, has that part, as Jim says, gotten kind of lost in the ways laws have changed?
It kind of has gotten lost, and it's still in the amendment as much now as the day it was written back in 1789. But in terms of the people involved in the January 6th uprising in Washington, D.C. from last year, they called themselves militias, but they're not militias, and they were not militias a year ago. Anybody can use that name, but under law, the term militia means a citizen-based but government-organized and regulated military-type body. And the term militia, unfortunately, has been distorted by groups like the people involved in the January 6th uprising last year.
Thanks for that call. And that's a change I think you've written about, Bob, between the idea of a collective right to own firearms in a well-regulated militia and an individual right to own and carry firearms. Can you talk about that transformation?
Well, sure. I mean, the Supreme Court brought that into sharp focus back in 2008 when they ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment provided a personal right of average citizens to have guns for personal protection in the home. And that kind of pushed aside the militia part, but that wording is still in the amendment. And more to the point, the militia-based focus or understanding of the Second Amendment was how it was interpreted in the first 200 years of our history. And the old style militias don't function today the way they did back in the 1700s and 1800s. And that's partly why the understanding of it has become obscured. But the government still has full regulatory power over what's called militias. And just because somebody says they're a militia, it doesn't make them a militia.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Andrew calling from Minnesota. Andrew, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Everything that my man just said there was informative, and I appreciate you for being here and sharing all that. So, like, I was, whenever I first got on, or I first turned you on and heard the Republican senator, he was, I think.
Assembly rep, but close enough.
talking about the bill that he was writing. And, like, I think it's a shame that it doesn't include, because he was saying, like, hey, we could, as long as we're going to treat all adults the same, like, this arbitrary change between 21 and 18, like specifically in regard to firearms, like that seems like everything he said about that seems super reasonable, right? It's just a shame that the bill doesn't actually advocate for making it to where it's like 21 across the board, given like everything that the guy, the gentleman who's sitting there talking with you now was talking about. Like, I mean, who wants to give 18-year-olds more guns and to have them like in some capacity where they're going to be specifically used like as a weapon, right? For in the instance of concealed carry. And like,
I gotcha, Andrew. Running a little short on time, Bob. A consistent adulthood standard of 21, I think Andrew is getting at.
Well, and that's a perfectly, you know, reasonable public policy argument you can make. And one of the reasons there's great concern about 18 to 20-year-olds is precisely we know that gun availability and easy handgun availability is closely tied to child suicides and also to violence. For example, 73 to 80% of school shooters got their guns from their homes or the homes of relatives and friends. So when handguns are readily accessible, and usually it's handguns that are used, by the way, not assault weapons, that when handguns are readily available, teenagers will sometimes blow a cork, they'll go up and shoot up a school or decide to kill themselves instead. And that's part of the problem with that in between age of 18 to 20.
In our last couple of minutes, Bob, a thorny issue. I know one people have tried to research a lot over the years. What does concealed carry, the prevalence of concealed carry, do when it comes to crime rates, particularly violent crime rates? Do we have any kind of solid conclusions at this point?
Well, there are some pretty clear conclusions. There was a book that came out some years ago called More Guns, Less Crime, which made that exact argument that the more guns civilian have has, the lower crime rates are. But it turns out that that data was not properly presented. And when other people looked at that data, it proved to demonstrate basically the opposite. And in recent years, there have been some important studies, one in particular, that found that violent crime increased from 13 to 15% in states that had loose carry, civilian carry laws compared to states that did not. So there is a correlation between more violent crime and more proliferation and carrying of guns by civilians in society.
I know you're always watching for the latest developments in gun laws and court rulings around the country. What kind of things do you have your eye on right about now?
There's a very big case before the Supreme Court. It was argued back on November 3rd. No telling when the court will hand down its decision. It's a challenge to New York State's concealed carry law, which has a fairly strict standard. And I know about that law because I obtained a concealed carry permit through the New York State law process. And it's being challenged as essentially too strict. And it looks as though the court is poised to strike down that law in part or in whole. It's hard to know how far they are going to go. But one thing is clear to me, which is that the Supreme Court didn't agree to hear a challenge to the strict New York concealed carry law to also rule that to then uphold that law. I don't think they're going to uphold it. We just don't know when that decision will come down. It could be as early as March, could be as late as June. That'll be a very important case.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York College at Cortland. He's the author of over a dozen books, including 5 on gun policy. He talked to us today about concealed carry and gun ownership under age 21. Earlier, we talked to Republican Assembly Representative Shay Sortwell, sponsor of a bill that would lower the concealed carry minimum age in Wisconsin from 21 to 18. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that and read more about it over at WPR.org. Catch up with the news coverage on that and share your thoughts in the comments section. You can also always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we'll meet some of the most significant women in the history of science and find out why their stories are often overlooked by history. We'll check out some of the individuals, hear their stories, their discoveries, and what it all means for the future of science. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You might like cinnamon rolls, a lot of people do. You might like chili, very popular. But have you ever eaten a cinnamon roll in a bowl of chili? Turns out it's a thing. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, cinnamon rolls served in a bowl of chili is something that people eat. And it's not a newfangled food fad for the hipsters. It goes back at least 100 years. It's a regional thing. The article said some places in the Midwest do it. Looks like that meant Nebraska. The origins, some say it was started in lumber camps. Others point to school lunch programs where cinnamon roll chili was a regular entree. Looks like it's mostly gone now from school lunch menus. That's a lot of fat and sugar in your main course there. Some restaurants do serve it, especially in Nebraska. Have you ever run into this? I want to know about it. Right now, please. Email or as soon as you can do it, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org is a bowl of chili with a cinnamon roll plopped down in it, a part of your food history. Two great tastes that taste great together. This is Central Time.